This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Ken, I'm really in deep distress because, you know, in the aftermath of the Great Depression, all that it's done is exacerbated the wealth disparity in the U.S. So what is to be done?
Well, we're going to ask that very question to William Spriggs, who serves as the chief economist of the AFL-CIO and is professor in and former chair of the Department of Economics at Howard University. In 2009, Bill was appointed by President Obama to serve as assistant secretary for the Office of Policy at the U.S. Department of Labor. He was vice chair of the Congressional Black Caucus's Political Education and Leadership Institute. So we're about to find out.
Well, I will restrain myself from immediately asking what is to be done. And William Spriggs, first of all, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And I was reading recent testimony from April 2008. 2015, before the EEOC confronting racial and ethnic discrimination in the 21st century workplace. It was such compelling testimony. I was wondering if you would give us some historic sense relevant to the issue which became most vibrant for me, relevant to the demands of the 1963 March for Jobs and Freedom on the Civil Rights Act. Help build the context for this discussion for us.
Thanks so much. A lot of people do remember the march in 1963, and a lot of people concentrate on the civil rights demands. But key among the demands was a demand to end discrimination in employment. This year we're celebrating the Voting Rights Act, which followed the next year. But the fear in 1963 was that politicians wouldn't want to play in their own playground. And even though voting rights clearly were important, A. Philip Randolph, who was the architect of the march, got everyone understanding that first we have to be able to have a job. And a lot of people forget, in 1962, 1963, if you opened up one ad, classified ad for help, it was perfectly legal to signal whether or not you were going to hire black people. You would see ads that clearly said white men wanted, white women wanted, black men wanted, colored men wanted, colored women wanted. I mean, this was quite typical. So we had jobs that clearly were inaccessible to the black community, and the clear demand that the marchers wanted was a way to end that, and more importantly, a way to enforce it. So the big fight between the civil rights movement and President Kennedy at the march was that President Kennedy had proposed a Civil Rights Act, but did not include an enforcement mechanism for ending discrimination in employment. The big fight between those who were speaking and John Lewis, who was representing the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and was a very young man at the time, was because Lewis wanted to really call out President Kennedy on that precise point. His speech from that day, John Lewis still made some comments about it, but it wasn't as pointed as he had originally drafted. The end result was that the marches, when they met with President Kennedy, stood their ground. It ended up being the central part of the act. The other interesting thing that is so important to understanding the poor pace of the recovery that we're under now is that the act also ended discrimination on the basis of gender. So we got an enforcement mechanism to end two very important ways in which our labor market looked so different before 1963. After that, labor force participation rate for women skyrocketed, and in response to having lots of new job opportunities, educational attainment on the part of African Americans skyrocketed. So we live in a totally different world today. Gaps between workers in terms of educational attainment are very small now compared to the 1960s. We actually have a labor market that is far more capable of filling almost any job. Unfortunately, we don't have policies that take full employment seriously. They still seem to be dominated by a world that was pre-1963. We still imagine that we're going to run out of skilled workers or something.
Harkening back to the 60s and Dr. King noted in a speech at Stanford in 1967 that the African-American unemployment rate was twice that of whites, and it still is. Now, let's talk about what's happening within the labor market right now. Even though the unemployment rate recently decreased to 5.1%, the African-American unemployment rate is over 9%. So what's going on here?
Unfortunately, in the 1970s, we reached a point where the unemployment rate for African-Americans with high levels of education was approximately the unemployment rate for whites with high levels of education. So at the end of the 1970s, if you were black and you could get to college and finish, you pretty much had the unemployment rate for whites with the same level of education, and the pay for equally educated blacks and whites was about equal. And that's when William Julius Wilson wrote his famous book predicting that, you know, we were going to see the end of race and we were going to only see a world based on class. Of course, what happened was the Federal Reserve stepped in the 1980s, pumped unemployment in this country into the stratosphere, created huge gaps. We have never returned to full employment again. And as a result, today, while we still say 2-to-1, it's more important to get underneath the numbers and see how stark these gaps are. And because of the advances in education in the African-American community, 2-to-1 is way less defensible and even more ugly. So in the report that just came out, if you were black and had an associate's degree, you had an unemployment rate that was, in fact, higher than if you were white and had only finished high school. In fact, if you were black and had a college degree, you had an unemployment rate that was higher than if you were white and just finished high school. So that's the level of absurdity we have in the current labor market. Because we are so far from full employment, we don't see employers under pressure to actually find skilled workers. They still get a freebie. They still can discriminate. And it's hurting our nation that we are so far from full employment. At the labor movement, we consider that we're at full employment when we actually get wages to rise. Wages should rise with reaching full employment. They should rise with productivity. Currently, wages in nominal terms are rising at a pace around 2% a year. That's about even with inflation. It's a little ahead of inflation, but only a little bit ahead. But it's nowhere near with productivity gains that we've seen since the recovery. The rise in inequality is that productivity of American workers continues to climb. Wages do not. Real wages over this recovery have gone up about 1.2%, 1.5%. Productivity has been up well over 6%. That gap between what we're producing and what American workers get paid, that goes to the 1%. That goes to make CEO salaries high. It goes to pay Wall Street all their money that they collect as their reward from the corporations, and workers don't see any of it. And in the African-American community, then that snowballs down because of the higher level of unemployment. It directly translates into lower wages because people with high unemployment rates, well, they have to accept lower wages because eventually they have to take a job. So the absurdity of the distance we are from full employment, of getting employers to be serious about hiring talented people, the seriousness of getting wages to rise, this is a big problem that we're confronting. Fortunately, you know, the New York Times did an op-ed pointing this out and pointing to the Federal Reserve and saying that now is not the time to raise interest rates because the point of raising interest rates is to slow job growth, and that's only going to exacerbate all of the issues that we just talked about. No wage growth for anybody and this huge disparity in unemployment rates.
I wonder if you can just add to the equation the question of the underemployment, the precarity, people who are certainly not full-time employees. What does that really begin to do to the persistent gaps?
They, of course, exacerbate them. They make them worse. What we have right now in the labor market, we always have a broader measure of unemployment. That includes people who are part-time because they would like to work full-time and the economy isn't generating enough full-time jobs. We have people who look at the labor market and kind of discouraged from looking, and they sit on the sidelines. So there's always this bigger, more broad measure of unemployment. That broader measure tends to be about 8% higher than the unemployment rate when the labor market is tight. Right now it's around 30% higher, which is still a level that indicates that people are being underemployed. They're not getting as many hours as they want. And then we had a really great study that came out of the Washington Center for Equitable Growth that was looking at recent college grads and young people and showing that what has happened over the last 14 years and accelerated even more during this recovery is that college-educated workers are displacing less educated workers. And this is the phenomena that everybody knows because their recent college grad is either working at Starbucks or working at McDonald's or working at Walmart, or they're doing anything to get a job. So we've seen this cascading down of college-educated workers into low-wage industries and to low-wage jobs, and this is cascading down onto the unemployment rate for those workers who typically got those jobs, high school-educated workers, workers who didn't finish high school. And that in the black community is what you see tripled because of the significantly higher unemployment rate faced by black college graduates. So black college graduates right now, if they're young, they're looking more like whites who finished high school. They're not looking like people who finished college, both in terms of the jobs they get to have and their unemployment rate. So right now, because we are so far from full employment, we are just wasting valuable resources in our communities. And when people can't solve it on their own, even with a college degree, young black workers cannot solve this problem, because even with a college degree, what they're doing is saying, oh, good, I get to be like a white high school graduate. That's not solving the problem. You can't solve it on your own. So we desperately need the Fed to be serious about its commitment to full employment. And Congress is contemplating shutting down the government. Republicans are once again trying to hold the gun to keep us from investing as we need to do in infrastructure, making investments that we need to be making in public education, all of this in the name of ruining the economy, because it's not in the name of helping the economy, and it's not in the name of helping our children who currently are so underemployed.
Double unemployment rate of African Americans. You're talking a lot about the Fed, and that would certainly alleviate a lot of problems. But it seems as if the African American community bears the brunt of any dysfunction of the American economy. Now, you were testifying before, or the paper you had given was to the EEOC, and you'd also mentioned certain studies that show the amount of discrimination against black workers throughout the country. Is there any role for the EEOC in terms of enforcement of non-discrimination law? And can it be bolstered?
I think it can be bolstered. We have seen, and it catches the eye of the press so much, when we do audit studies, that is, send resumes to firms that only differ by race. And we see the response of the firms, and it's not surprising. African Americans face a far tougher chance of getting to the interview stage. And when we used to do actual audits, when we actually sent people, not just resumes, you saw that even at the interview stage, African Americans found it far harder to get their foot in the door with employers. I think the EEOC and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs has to be far more aggressive with firms on this issue. They really do need to take advantage of what we have found through the audits and start doing audits on their own. Especially in the case of federal contractors, they need to monitor application process.
You know, Bill, one of the things that I see in the work that I do as a civil legal aid attorney is the growing impoverishment and heretofore new groups of people who are impoverished. Many of them were public sector workers, African-American women, who lost their jobs during the recession periods and are not likely to regain employment. So I see the fact that there may be gains in hiring overall and presumably a falling unemployment rate and other signs of an improving economy. But the take-home pay for so many American workers has really fallen since the economic recovery began in 2009. I represent people who hold the home health care workers, the food preparation and retail workers. They're really a step away from destitution. Now, we have the wonderful, you know, 15 and a union movement. But can you talk more about that whole issue and who is primarily affected of those lowest paid workers? What is to be done about that sector of the employment market? I don't see either the Democratic or Republican leaders in Washington doing very much to improve the living standards for those workers.
Congress has been totally stymied. They haven't done anything except investigate Hillary Clinton on Benghazi and spend all their time trying to repeal the Health Care Act. So they haven't looked at anything at all that is related to what happens to the paycheck of American workers and how to get it up. That's why you see the campaign that you saw in New York around the $15 minimum for restaurant workers, and that's why you see fights going on in city after city to raise the wage. Currently, Congress has a bill to raise the minimum to $12 by 2020. Congress hasn't held a hearing on that yet, nor a vote on it yet. So Congress has turned a deaf ear to this. During the downturn, the Bureau of Labor Statistics documented that total compensation, not just wages, but workers have also been taking it on the chin because their employers are forcing them to contribute more to their health care and more to their retirement. Total compensation for the bottom 70% of workers is still below 2007, and wages are below for 80%. So you're right, wages have not come back for 80% of the American workforce, and compensation hasn't come back for 70% of the American workforce. People are being pushed down the ladder. The share of full-time, full-year workers who live in poverty is still too staggering. You raise the issue of African-American women. Among African-American women who work full-time, full-year, 18% live in poverty. They work full-time, full-year, almost one in five of those African-American women are living in poverty. That's absurd. And that means that people, again, are being put in a position that they cannot solve this on their own. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They're working. They're working full time. They're working the whole year, and they can't get out of poverty. We have to have policies that change, and it's policies that create this level of frustration for people because they're doing what they're supposed to do. They're getting education. They're working, and still the system rewards the 1%. It's designed so that we have levels of unemployment that chase down wages, and then every time you turn around and we talk about we need minimum wages, we need workers to be able to organize, you hear that, oh, that's just going to be bad. It's just going to hurt the workers. And of course, all of that is to scare workers because in reality, what we have seen over the last 30 years is, no, all of that goes to the 1%. This is to make CEOs fatter.
Would one of the solutions be to reconstruct the welfare system? I know that it was pretty much decimated under Clinton with the institution of TANF, but not only for the people who would get the benefits, it would create a floor that would increase the wage rates. In fact, King, in that 1967 speech at Stanford, talked about a national minimum income. So do we need to start talking about those kinds of things again also?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought up Dr. King's call for national minimum income, because as he pointed out, poverty is all about you don't have money. If we're not going to be serious about full employment, so we're telling people that you are not going to be able to solve this problem on your own, you're not going to be able to work your way through this problem, then as a society, we have to take social responsibility. Can't have a just society where everything is on the individual. Some of what society is requiring require society to react. We did that with the Social Security Act, and you see the gaps that are remaining. So if you're unemployed, we have an unemployment system run by states. It's wholly inadequate. In fact, it collapsed during the Great Recession, and what has been hobbled back together by states is, in fact, a smaller program that is nowhere near the size or as generous as it would need to be if we went into another downturn. So we have to revisit what happens if I lose my job or what happens if I can't find a job. A large share of the people who can't find jobs right now are young people, and they don't get into the system at all. So when you look at the share of people who are under 25 who have not held a job or only been able to hold part-time jobs, Mimi, I think you also raised the issue of the only thing they can seem to be able to do is be an Uber driver. We don't have a system to help them. They have no access to support of any kind. So we have to look back at the Social Security Act, where TANF originated, and understand from this experience what didn't get covered and how can we expand and make it a better safety net. One of the big things we're going to have to change is how we expand the existing Social Security safety net, because firm after firm after firm is withdrawing from defined benefit plans. The flat nature of pay is total compensation. So firms have not been kicking in to look after and help people with retirement. It's all falling more and more on workers, and Social Security, as we designed it, wasn't adequate for that. It was only designed to be one-third of your retirement. And now it needs to be more than one-third because people don't have defined benefit programs to protect them. In Canada right now, they're going to have their elections in October, they are talking about doubling their Social Security payments.
Along with the stagnant or falling wages, one of the most persistent complaints about the current economic expansion is that, of course, many jobs created so far have been low-paying ones. We've kind of talked about that, but there was an example that was brought to my attention recently of a Daryl Odom, who had worked at Kentucky Fried Chicken earning $5.50 an hour, and that was in the mid-1990s. After 2 years of college and now after two military tours in Iraq and other jobs, he's back working as a cook at an Atlanta location of the fried chicken chain. This time it's at an hourly rate of $7.25 an hour. Are we going to be able to, with the decline of manufacturing, etc., the increase of robotization, can we create the jobs? While we're talking about full employment, can we create the kind of jobs for Daryl Odom? And that's without talking about what you pointed out, that even, of course, based on the education level, the unemployment rates between blacks and whites are thoroughly stubborn, regardless of the level of education. Wow, that's an awful lot, but you're up to the task.
Well, a lot of people want to talk about robots getting rid of jobs, but robots got rid of jobs back in the 50s and 60s when manufacturing went from Rosie the Riveter to modern manufacturing. That increase in productivity got converted into increased wages. So we didn't lose jobs because wages kept up with productivity and we were able to sustain growth through growing demand. The problem we have now aren't robots. The problem is that the jobs are being sent to other countries. And that gets to our trade policy, and we have to totally revisit the world that we've created post-NAFTA in terms of manufacturing and manufacturing wages. It's now a problem for China. China's reached the middle income growth trap because as they try and raise their wages, they lose jobs now to Vietnam, Thailand, Malaysia, Burma, and you can keep adding names of other countries that are willing to do jobs that the Chinese were doing for less. So we need a new global pact for what we do with wages the current way we think about trade is what has gotten the world into the glut that it's in right now. And no one has a real solution. Japan has been stuck with its weak economy for over 25 years now, and Europe looks like it's trying very hard to do the same thing. And China may have a slow growth for, they think, 3 years, but it may end up being 6 or 7 or 8 years, and maybe 10 years, because of this problem of not being able to get manufacturing wages correct. The thing that we are learning about inequality that I don't think people hit on, because we normally think of inequality as immoral, but it goes beyond that. It hurts firm formation. When wages were rising for everyone in the United States at the same rate, it meant that the customer base in the United States was always rising. It meant that firms could always find new customers. But when you stagnate the economy and people at the bottom are frozen, they don't become new customers. So you can't expand. You can't get new businesses to form. So in the same 30-year period that the share of the workforce that is unionized has gone down, in the same 30 years where the income that goes to the top 1% has been going through the ceiling, and the same 30 years where we cut corporate income tax, it has also been the case that new companies are not forming in the United States. The rate at which new companies are forming is slowing down as much as inequality is going up. And it's just that simple. It sounds like, oh, well, companies just need sales. No, companies need customers. And so when you have whole segment, now over 60% of the American workforce, without rising income, well, they don't become new customers. And firms then turn on each other. They compete by stealing customers. They don't compete by trying to get new customers. Their profit shares go up because they are intensifying what they can get out of their existing customers. So rather than profit shares staying flat, as you would expect in a competitive framework, it's that profit shares go up because I just keep jacking up the prices on the customers I already have. And then it creates this cycle, because then I want to keep wages down. I want to try and squeeze as much profit as I can out of the situation because I'm not getting new customers. And then it keeps feeding on itself. That's where we're stuck. So inequality hurts growth, it hurts business, and it's only the greed of those who are at the top that we perpetuate these policies as if it's supposed to be business friendly. It's not business friendly, it's rich people friendly, and that's how we have to understand these policies.
Well, William Spriggs, Chief Economist of the AFL-CIO, thank you for helping us confront racial and ethnic discrimination in the 21st century workplace. It's been a pleasure, as always, speaking with you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.